Welcome to Ex Chateau.
Ex Chateau.
The podcast that navigates the business of wine with unique perspectives and insights. With your hosts, Robert Vernick and Peter Young.
Welcome to this episode of Ex Chateau. Today, we're going to be continuing our dive into discussing importers. And our guest today is Shannon Corsi, the EVP of Sales and Marketing of Wilson Daniels, which focuses on family-owned wineries and includes many historical luxury wineries. Shannon, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. Happy to be here.
Could you please give me and Peter a brief overview of your background?
Sure. I'm based here in New York City, and I moved here in 2001, January of 2001, quite a while ago to chase my childhood dream of being in the music business. So that's what brought me from the DC area up here, which I did that for a few years. Spent every penny I made on food and wine and running around the city and travel, and had some friends that were in hospitality and were in the wine business, which was intriguing to me that was a career, and ultimately got successfully recruited over to this industry. And it's been a wild ride. I've not looked back. I was 30 years old when I got in the business, actually. So it was nice that I had some other experience in hospitality and customer service and just the overall hustle of the city. I think I first joined a small distributor. It was small when I joined, and then it was very quickly purchased by the largest of distributors. So that was a very interesting experience. I did that for about 4 years. And then in 2010, started working for Vineyard Brands, which was a really incredible 5 years of my career. I was running Metro New York. And in 2015, I was recruited by Rocco Lombardo, who's the president of Wilson Daniels, was previously the president of Fred Wildman, to join Wilson Daniels as the Northeast VP. So based here, but running DC to Maine. So running 14 states for Wilson Daniels, which was great. And even in those 8 years since then, the portfolio has changed, you know, dramatically. So it's been a very exciting, very quick moving, and very successful 8 years together with our really impressive team. In 2019, I was promoted to SVP of Sales and National Sales Manager. And then just last year was promoted to oversee marketing and public relations in addition to sales.
For our listeners who aren't that familiar with Wilson Daniels, yeah, could you give them a brief overview of its background and what it covers now?
Sure. Its background, you know, is actually pretty lengthy. It was founded in 1978 by Jack Daniels and Win Wilson, hence the name. Jack Daniels is actually still on our board of directors, which is kind of cool to have, you know, his insight and the stories from, you know, his decades running the company. Win Wilson unfortunately passed in 2006. He died really young, early 60s from cancer, but was an exceptional person from, you know, all accounts that I hear. But they were focused on representing really the highest quality wineries from their respective regions. And then fast forward, you know, 46 years later to today, that's really what we're focused on as well. So that mission has not changed. The portfolio has changed dramatically, but the focus on the higher end, I would say, is still similar. And today we represent 37 families from all around the globe, which in turn is about 50 producers, because some families have, you know, multiple projects or multiple wineries in different countries even sometimes. But we're a supplier, we're an importer. But as I said to you before we started, I think, you know, we consider ourselves really a sales and marketing company, because that's the focus of our business. And that's what we're doing day in and day out. The one thing I do think is interesting is, historically, when Wynn and Jack started the company, it was predominantly more of like a brokerage company. It was focused on domestic wineries. And it wasn't until 1979, so just a year after they started, that Aubert de Valen and La Loubise Loire asked them if they wanted to represent Romani Conti. So that's actually what really catapulted the business to start focusing on imports as well as domestic wineries, and kind of changed what their mission was originally when they were representing things like Chateau Montelena and more domestic properties.
So I am curious then, just to give some of our listeners some context on how it works. Like, obviously sales and marketing is a big part of it, but bringing wines in as well, like that, there's relationships on the other side as well. So I'm curious if you could kind of give an overview of like how importers really work and what's maybe the one of the main, having worked at a couple of them or a couple organizations like this, like what is the main differences that you see at Wilson Daniels in terms of how it sets up and works?
I think, well, if, I guess the first part of your question, firstly, we're curating a portfolio, right, that we're passionate about, which is always an ongoing process. You know, we're always looking for new opportunities. However, I think kind of staying consistent in the size that you think you're going to be most successful with is also important, and not just kind of grabbing everything that comes your way. So portfolio first, and then I think one of the biggest aspects of being an importer is distributor management. We have, I'm sure we'll get into this, we have our own distributor in 5 states, but that means in 45 states, we have a third-party distributor who we have to work very closely with to make sure that the strategy we put together, you know, with each of our wineries is executed. And we're pretty meticulous in that, I will say. And that includes everything from, you know, the message. I think coming up with the message with the winery is the most important piece, the vision that they have as a family, and then what they see, you know, the next 1, 5, 10, 100 years looking like for that winery and how we can help them accomplish that in the States. And with that can come coming up with a pricing model, right? We're pretty diligent about keeping pricing consistent around the country. I think that's something that some people miss because, you know, you can easily go down the road of kind of racing to the bottom in order to get business. And we do the complete opposite. We want the same price in all 50 states. It's good for our producers. And I think it's good for the customer and our distributors and also our team. So they're not out there negotiating price every day. We're talking about the wine and what's in the bottle and the family instead. We are pretty bullish on education, you know, with our team and also externally with our distributors. I think in that strategy, when you're a wine importer, looking at things like channel mix is important, right? If you have a producer that wants to focus only on restaurants, because there's not very much of it, or if it's something more volumetric, and there's an opportunity for national accounts or chains, I think it's important to identify that instead of kind of letting it just kind of happen on its own, you know, because then you're getting away from the initial vision, I think, from the winery. And then, of course, we work very closely with the press. So that's something that needs to be agreed upon, you know, right off the bat, is who do we want to make sure these producers are connected with? So we're always working on keeping those connections and relationships moving forward with both Wilson Daniels, you know, internally, and also, of course, all of our producers. And then lastly, keeping the wineries really top of mind in the trade. So the way we do that is just being hyper, hyper active in the trade. We do a lot of events, tastings, vintage releases, you know, late night sommelier events, launches, because we've been very busy launching new producers the last few years. So yeah, just kind of keeping busy in all 50 states with our team and, you know, going back to the first thing I said, with our distributors, because we can't do it without them.
And so maybe focusing a little on sourcing, Wilson Daniels has one of the most curated, probably luxury portfolios of any of the importers or sales and marketing companies in the US, including DRC, Laflave, Gaia, people like that. Did the portfolio always start out as such a high-end portfolio?
It did, you know, definitely with the story I told about Romani Conti kind of being one of our newest producers, that set a pretty high bar, as you can imagine, for everything that was added, you know, since then. That said, Wilson Daniels has gone through a lot of iterations of itself. I think, you know, when Jack retired, maybe, I don't know, 20 years ago, there was a 10-year period that I hear of often in my travels. I was not around for it, neither was Rocco, where there were many different leaders and presidents over a decade. And I think, you know, it sounds like it was a pretty rocky road. And in that time, the portfolio, I think, changed. There were a lot of private labels, and I think there was even a Wilson Daniels brand, you know, out there that I hear about. So, you know, I'd like to say, yes, we've always been focused on the high end, but it's been a 46-year journey that there's been, you know, different leaders throughout that time. I can tell you the first 20 years of Wilson Daniels, absolutely. And the last 8 years, probably more than ever, has been a focus of luxury and also authenticity. You know, when we're looking at who we want to partner with, we really try to first of all, we're very interested in the people that we work with, you know, and making sure that we've got some shared values with the families that we are going to be so closely, you know, putting their vision together with. And we care about holdings, right? I mean, estate properties are very interesting to us. A winery that has the ability to scale is sometimes interesting to us. Obviously, that's not the whole portfolio. It's not even a third of the portfolio, but it's nice to have some producers that have the ability to grow along with us. And then we look for maybe a specific region to make sure that we're not doubling up and adding something that's actually going to take away from somebody else. You know, we're constantly kind of asking if there's anything that we can do to make sure we're doing more for a producer, we will. And sometimes that means saying no to a winery that's interested in working with us.
So along those lines, how important is focusing on the where you source from, you know, not having ones that are super competitive, but and some people, some importers will focus on specific regions or countries, and others like yours are global. How important do you think that focus is?
I think it's important. I think focus in general is very important. We break our portfolio up just generally speaking, because there are some exceptions, but it's about a third from France, a third from Italy, a third New World. We also have, you know, the high end wineries from Familia Torres. We have Royal Tokaj in Hungary. So that's not all encompassing, but for the most part, that's how it's broken up. And I think the best thing that we have realized at this exact moment is that we can't be everything for everyone, right? I think it's good to allow focus, not just for ourselves, but for our team and for our distributors while we're in an era of such consolidation, because we are, you know, all the big companies are just getting bigger and bigger. And we're with two of the bigger distributors around the country. You know, we're with RNDC and Breakthrough in many states, in more than half the states, who do a very good job for us, but they're big. So the best thing we can do is put together a portfolio and then almost groupings within the portfolio to help them focus on our wines. Because, you know, we have a team of, I think we're up to about 35 national sales individuals, sales managers around the country, but we're also selling over 600,000 cases a year now. So they can't do it on their own. We have to have the distributor helping us, and they can't sell some of our producers that are like 50, 60 cases. And if we keep adding those to the portfolio, it's going to cause a lot of noise. So it's important to focus and be careful with getting a little bit too big and too complicated, I think.
But with like the Royal Tokaj as an example, is that something you're like, we want to get like a pinnacle sweet wine, and you're like, if we go to Tokaj, Royal Tokaj is one of the, you know, most famous names there. Was it you were looking for that? It was something to fill out your portfolio when that decision was made?
Yeah, well, that predates me. That I think that was in 1992. But to answer your question, we're both opportunistic. So if something like that comes to us and it does have that pedigree, we're going to be interested, and we're going to at least speak with them, and in often cases go there and see what the property in the region is about. But I would say at this point, I think the only additions we'd really be looking to make would be maybe adding another grower champagne producer, maybe adding another Burgundy producer or two that are in regions that we're already representing, and we're already educating our team and our distributors about. I think it's going to be a minute before there's anything from a new country that we're going to add to your point.
So in terms of like understanding, because obviously given the pedigree of your portfolio, I'm sure a lot of people want to join. What do you think is the optimal size of a book for an importer, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think we're there. That's kind of what I was alluding to, is we've added 20 of our 37 families or whatnot, I said earlier, have been brought to the portfolio in the last 8 years, and about half of those in the last 3 years. And this is where we want to be, you know, especially with the last two producers we added, the Gaia family and the four properties they represent, and then Domaine Favoli. And that included also Beyond Simone, which they recently purchased, in Chablis. So those are two two producers we've had our eyes on and really, really respected and thought would kind of fill the gaps, as you speak of our portfolio, and add to it instead of take away focus from other areas and other regions. And you add to those pickups a couple other smaller things that we've added to the portfolio, like Domaine Lamont Fornois, which is a project with Raphael Baresh and his cousin Juliette Alipes. We added Domaine de Nozé. It's a Sancerre producer from, it's actually Aubert de Valens' nephew and Bertrand de Valens' cousin. So these are wineries we would not want to pass up, but we added them all in a 2-year period. So I really think we're at kind of the perfect place, and it's going to be in our best interest to kind of sit and settle and make sure that everybody is growing and everyone is performing in the portfolio instead of, you know, just the new producers or the exist, you know. So that's kind of where we are as far as Wilson Daniels goes, but to each their own. You know, other structures could probably handle more. We are very, very interested in making sure that we don't miss a beat from those producers that I mentioned that have been with us for 46 years also, you know.
Do those count as new families, or are they just part of the same family?
That's a good question. They're part of the 37 families, but the 50 producers.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, I was just going to say Clos du Dal is the same thing in terms of with Lefebvre, right?
Exactly.
So it's like you're like, usually when there's those offshoots, they don't start off too big, right? So
exactly. Exactly. And we've got Hyde de Valens with Aubert de Valens and Larry Hyde. Bertrand de Valens is making wine in Oregon right now, which is really cool. He's got created a winery called Composition. So there's a lot of things that have just naturally come to the portfolio because of the relationships with the families, which is great. I mean, it's a good position to be in, but it also means we've got to like tone it down with some of our recruiting, I think, for a second.
And so I'm curious on the value that the wineries get, because obviously they have there's choices for who they work with in each country. And so if you were in their shoes, what would be their reason for choosing Wilson Daniels versus another importer?
I think that what's attractive about Wilson Daniels, it's hard to say because, you know, I work here, but I am in those meetings when we're talking to producers who are considering coming to us. And I do think what is exciting to many of them is how focused we are in the on-trade. You know, 62% of our business is on-premise and 80% of our business is in the independent channel. And that's, you know, that's a lot of work, right? Because these aren't big drops. These are the team out there every day, just making sure we've got those relationships in every city and every state. And that's hard to build. And I think that's attractive to a producer who knows that there's so much visibility in being in the finest restaurants in the country and of course in the world. So to me, I think that's something that's attractive to them. We work tirelessly to get their wines in the right places. We have a lot of reporting that shows us, you know, we can drill down to Michelin star restaurants or Grand Award restaurants or by city or new restaurants. Have you gotten this producer in there? This makes perfect sense for them. So I think our kind of obsession about caring for the wines and getting them in the right place is probably brings a level of comfort to a winery.
And you mentioned, you know, you've been with the de Valens family for a long time. How long are the relationships you generally have with winery partners? And are they usually exclusive or not exclusive?
Yeah, all exclusive. That's a good question. But yes, everyone that we work with exclusively represent them in all 50 states. There are some that we don't get enough wine to go in all 50 states. There are many, actually. So that's another part of kind of them putting their trust in us is coming up with the strategy of where the wine should go first off and foremost, and then from there down to where the accounts they should be in, you know? So we really manage it from the winery down to the consumer level. As far as how long we've worked with some of those folks, yeah, you know, I mentioned Royal Tokai, Kuma River, we've been with since 1991 also. I finally had the pleasure of going there in November, and it's so amazing to see the changes that they've brought to the community and the winemaking world in New Zealand. It's really cool. I mean, and they're so close to Auckland. That was really surprising to me because New Zealand is such a vast, open, you know, country. And I've been to other regions and it was really surprising how, you know, you get off the plane and it's like a 30-minute ride, not even, but it's really remarkable the impact they've had on the wine business. And working with them has just been a real honor. And then Schramsberg and Lefebvre, we've been with Domaine Lefebvre and the Davies family from Schramsberg since 1996. So we've had a lot of companies or a lot of families stay with us for quite some time, which is why I say it's really important to us that we, you know, continue to do right by everybody in the portfolio, because there's a lot of loyalty going in both directions there.
Right. And with the focus on the higher end and the luxury brands, how do you think representing a luxury brand differs from, you know, a more mass market or commercial brand in your view?
That's a great question. I think we definitely lean a lot more towards the former. We do a lot of kind of grassroots marketing, honestly. It is a lot of events. It is a lot of, as I said, the visibility that comes with what we're selling into the on-premise, we consider marketing, because it's really about having those wines in those restaurants on those lists. We also have a private client group, right? So we're not missing out on the ability to market our luxury wines to those collectors who are seeking out many of the wines that we sell. So we do that with exclusive events that we have for them. We bring them to the wineries and have some more experience-driven activity with them. So it's not just all about allocations. And then with the trade, we joke that we're a travel agency sometimes, because we're constantly bringing people to visit our wineries around the world. And I think that's really important marketing, because it sticks, you know, and it's, people move around, as you guys know, in this business quite a bit, but it's nice when you can actually build a connection and a relationship between a customer and the winery, and that relationship hopefully usually follows, you know, to the next role. But yeah, with mass marketing, it's not really our core competency. We've dipped our toes in it a little bit, but surely, you know, national accounts would be a factor there. Getting more volumetric placements in chains would certainly, you know, check that box. And then consistent pricing, you know, it's the same for volumetric brands as it is for our higher end brands. I think that's important, but we haven't delved too deep into this world, because we just don't have the quantities. You know, two-thirds of our portfolio is allocated to us, so there isn't any more wine to buy. So it's really important for us to be thoughtful about how we're breaking up those allocations by market. And then we kind of have to just focus on where the wines go, instead of just mass market and, you know, wait for the sales to roll in. We don't have enough wine to do that.
So in terms of marketing, how do you think about building your winery partners' brands in the US? Do you have a playbook that you liked, or is it sort of customized by winery?
We definitely like to work with the winery to create the messaging. And through that comes a lot of activity afterwards, which is education, of course, to our own wholesale, you know, teams in those five states I mentioned, to our national team, of course, who is really going to be driving that messaging home every day, and then to the distributors. Secondly, we would create a PR launch kit, right? And a sales kit. And then identifying channel mix, I think, making sure that we're really buttoned up with regards to where we want the wines to end up. And that would include target account list in most cases. Events are really different based on the producer. So while we might focus on a vintage release with, you know, Beyond DeSanti or Domaine Faiveley, with Gaia, our events have been very different because they have four properties. So, you know, we'll do a Gaia Whites launch in the spring, and then we'll focus on their two Tuscan properties in the fall. And then we'll do maybe a Sicilian tasting with, you know, we have three Sicilian wineries now. So coming up with that plan, I think, is extremely fun. And it's something we don't do without the input, of course, of the families representing the winery. But that also goes back down to on-premise. You know, we have a deep respect for that trade. And I think most of the time, that's where our launches start, is really trying to get the sommelier teams to get behind the wines that we've picked up.
So it sounds like it all starts with that initial messaging and then education, and leading to, you know, further steps that are more tactical. In terms of that, how often when you're working with wineries, do they already have that kind of buttoned up messaging? And is that really true to, like, in their ethos, or is that something that their messaging for each country is? Like, how do the wineries think about that?
That's a good question. Oh gosh, it really varies, right? Some, you know, we look at someone like a Nicolas Joly, where I don't think he's ever sat down and created maybe like his message, but, you know, boy, does he have one. It's decades of him, you know, teaching biodynamics around the world and teaching other vigneron, and not just in France, but truly in other regions as well. So we try and take that history or that experience and put it in something that's really palatable for the states, for whether it's the press or whether it's the trade. I think that's helpful. But to your point, a lot of them already come with pretty amazing messaging. The Gaia family certainly did. I mean, they knew what they wanted, and they wanted more consistent pricing and better messaging of the four properties. They didn't feel like they were being looked at as four producers, and understandably so, because Gaia is so iconic, right? So our mission from them, which we happily accepted and are working very closely with them to do, is to really market their four wineries in Italy. And so I think that's a really, really interesting question. And it varies so much what people come to us with. Some folks are just, they just know they can do better, or historically, the marketing for their wines was only about price, right? Which isn't, I don't think, going to be good for anybody. So we really have to assess that first. What are they looking for? Whether it's something that they've already put on paper, or whether it's something that's in their mind that we can help them shout from a mountaintop around the country.
So it's an interesting segue too. I'm curious on how it works when you, because a lot of times you're dealing with historic brands as they come to you. How often do you have to, like, you know, doing damage control or reinterpreting, like, what's, or fixing something? Like, they're clearly changing for a reason, whether they there's new management or acquired or things. I'm thinking, like, Beyond Ascendo is acquired. And so, like, they're switching everything up. So I'm curious on how much, like, when you inherit someone, you know, who's already been in the market from another importer, like, how much do you have to, like, go through and, like, triage and look at their situation and address your initial game plan that you talked about earlier, which is, like, you know, pretty clean. It's a clean slate when someone's new coming into the market. You can kind of like map it all out.
I think Beyond DeSanti is such a good example. We had Beyond DeSanti and maybe a little bit of similar projects, I will say, with Del Forno when we picked up Del Forno, because I think they'd both been kind of kicked around a little bit. And the wine in the bottle, as I'm sure you both know, is exceptional. I mean, exceptional. They are top of class from their regions, but their reputation and the way that they were marketed had really been hurt, you know, for decades. And we had to kind of dust them off a little bit. And that isn't just messaging. Actually, in both of those cases, it also meant working through inventory in the gray market, right? And we had to be patient with that. We didn't want to lower our price to try to match anything out there, because then what are we doing, right? We're not building anything. So I think we had to really work with our teams and our distributors to kind of move through some of that inventory while we made a big splash about new releases of vintage and, you know, definitely focused on getting a little bit more of the story out there. We had both families in the market all the time when we launched both of those producers. And then the other thing we did with Del Forno especially is they agreed to launch the wines in the U.S., every vintage, at least 6 months prior to any other country. And it really helped slow down and almost eliminate some of that gray market activity for us. So kind of thinking of ways to really reset the table with some of these producers when we pick them up is important. And with that, you know, going back to your question about how do you choose a winery, that's when you really have to trust your palate and the team's palate, right? Because you're going after a producer that maybe doesn't have the cachet anymore. It should, and it used to, but it, for some reason, it hasn't been marketed, you know, correctly for the last, you know, so many years. So you really have to reset. And that's fun, because right now we sell out of every single bottle we get and then some. We're always asking for more of both of those producers. And, you know, they're back at the top of their game, as they always should have been.
So I'm curious, because you had mentioned gray market. Obviously, it seems with the internet, I even know retailers who have to pick up wines that their clients want from gray market in order to sell them. So I'm curious on how big of a problem that is. And when, in your view, when did that gray market really start to, like, maybe be impactful to a business like yours?
We try not to get too concerned with it. It's there, obviously. And being in New York City is interesting. San Francisco's got certainly some of this too, where you guys are, but restaurants have the ability to kind of get whatever they want, right? So I think talking about provenance is really important when we're speaking about our wines, because you know what you're getting. We can guarantee it. The winery guarantees it. So I think we gravitate towards customers who think that's important. Secondly, with at least Domaine de la Romanée Conti and Domaine Lefleuve, we track every single bottle we sell. We track it all the way to the customer. And we don't just track the bottles we sell. We track the trucks that they're delivered from our warehouse to our distributor's warehouse on, and we track the temperature inside of those trucks. So, I mean, we are obsessive with caring for those wines and where they go. And we're certainly looking for customers with the same respect for the wines that we have, right? So that's really how we try to control, in the small way that we can, gray market activity, is really trying to find folks who are going to treat the wines with the care that they've promised us and the Domaine and Lefleuve that they will.
So you touched upon this with the tracking and of DRC and whatnot. But so what do you think is the difference between marketing an iconic brand like Domaine de la Romanée Conti versus one, well, any of them are lesser known, but versus a more lesser known brand?
Well, definitely they're both so fun. But yeah, for sure, they're very different. And it kind of goes to what I was just saying about something like Romanée Conti. It's more about caring for, from start to finish, how those logistically those wines are handled and where they're going. So we're pretty close with the process with our distributors. We work closely with the allocation process of those wines. And that's really probably one of the most important pieces of having the honor to work with something like Romanée Conti or Domaine Lefleuve or Domaine Favoli or Gaia or Beyond di Santi. It's really a big responsibility, you know, to the people who own those wineries. And so we don't take that lightly. With a lesser known brand, it's more about visibility, right? I mean, the producers I just mentioned have the visibility. So it's more about taking care of the wines. Whereas with something that we're really launching to the US market, or in some cases relaunching, right? I think it's more about the messaging, and we can be a little louder and a little more active. And in some cases we have more wine, so we can, you know, even use things like social media and have a broader base with our messaging. So I think that's probably the biggest difference, is sometimes we have to be really insular and really focused with our message for the really allocated wineries. Whereas when we have a little bit more wine to get our hands on and maybe a lesser known producer, we can kind of try more things out and be a little more vast with our message.
And this probably varies by that brand strength and the differences we just talked about, but what have you seen as the most effective marketing strategies to build the demand for your portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what we do is, it really is grassroots, you know, and there's kind of a less sexy aspect of it, which I would say is a lot of the distributor management, because it's pricing, it's inventory. You know, there's not many things that are less exciting to talk about, but we talk about it every single day. It's programming sometimes, you know, with wineries that we have enough wine to do so with the distributor. And then, of course, you know, the more sexy aspect is we're overseas a lot. We're bringing people to the wineries every single month. We're at the best venues in the country doing the events that we're doing, because, you know, there's a little bit of marketing of the winery and of ourselves with the places we choose, I think, to host some of these events. So it's definitely a combination of both of those aspects, with the difference of scale of the winery that we'd be talking about. It really is profile distribution, regardless of how big the winery is or what kind of winery is. It's just that those profile distribution end customers might be different based on the winery. But at the end of the day, I think that's the biggest aspect of our marketing of brands is where they end up.
So how important is marketing to the end consumer versus trade for your portfolio? You mentioned a lot of things about trade earlier on, but I'm just curious on how that resonates with end consumer versus trade.
I would say we're in the stage of infancy in in the direct-to-consumer marketing. And we've dipped our toes in it a little bit. Jaylene would know very well. His sales and marketing worked very closely on a Bisol tour. So our Prosecco producer is 21st generation, you know, as authentic as you get, but it was still Prosecco. And we had some scalability with them. So it was something that was kind of a category that the consumers, I think, consider fun. And we had enough wine that we could really invest in something like this. So that's both of those things are not common in our portfolio, right? So we put together, it was like a 15 city tour with Gianluca Bisol. We wrapped an Alfa Romeo in like Bisol green, and we went and did press events, consumer events, and trade events in every city. And it was a blast, but I can tell you, I think every single human being that works in our company touched that event in some way, shape, or form. I mean, it was so much work for us, and it did yield results. I mean, I will tell you, that's a brand we took from 17,000 cases in 2015 to we're going to do 120,000 cases this year. So I can't say that it didn't work, because we had quite a spike after that as well, but it's just not how we're set up. You know, again, going back to the fact that 2/3 of our portfolio is allocated to us and doesn't have scalability makes it difficult sometimes for us to think on that scale. That said, I think it's something that we're going to think about this year, not just marketing direct to consumer for our wineries, but I think, you know, looking at Wilson Daniels as a company and maybe thinking a little bit more about, you know, having people outside of trade and outside of the press know who Wilson Daniels is. With that, maybe, you know, trusting if they see Wilson Daniels on the back of a bottle, they kind of know what to expect. So I do think there's an opportunity for us there. But it's difficult with the size of the allocations we get. On the like uber luxury side, that's a little bit different, I think, because we do have the ability to market to collectors who are the end consumer, right? So we have exclusive events for our collectors. Like I said, we bring them over to the winery so that they can make personal relationships there. And that is an important aspect of marketing luxury wine, is not losing the connection with the collectors who have been, in some cases, supporting these wineries for decades, right? So yeah, I think the three aspects of marketing luxury wines for us, it's the sommeliers, it's the collectors, and it's the critics.
So in terms of building those relationships, obviously Wilson Daniels pretty easily, given their focus on trade and building it with the Somms. In terms of collectors, is that something that you're looking for them to support your whole portfolio or big parts of your portfolio, or are they just dialing into certain aspects of it? Because obviously people are fairly brand loyal.
Yep, that's a great question. We have a gentleman whose name is Mike Hoagland, my colleague who runs our private client group, and he has done an exceptional job of really transforming our private client group. When we started 8 years ago with the company, he came on not far behind. A lot of historical members of the private client group were only buying Romani Conti, and that's not a way to do business in our eyes. And it's also not respectful to the other amazing producers that we have in the portfolio. So he's done a really great job making this more experience driven. And it's not just about an allocation to one winery. It's about learning about the breadth of our portfolio, going to the wineries from not just even Burgundy, but other countries. You know, he did an Italy trip last year. I think he's going to do a Spain trip. So now the folks that are in our private client group, and to be totally transparent, there's only 300 members in our private client group. It's very small. It's members only, it's invitation only, but it's very small because, again, we don't have the wine to grow it much more than that. But what's important to us, sure, is that the individuals in that group are supporting the other wineries within the book. Now, are they going to have like the entry level, you know, Rosé from Parasol? No. And we wouldn't even offer it to them. But they're going to take Chateau Parasol or a 3-liter of their, you know, their estate. So it's pretty cool to watch that program evolve into what it has, actually.
And in terms of marketing, so it was great in terms of answering how collectors see Wilson Daniels. I think that's a super interesting thing. And obviously, clearly how Somms would see it. But in terms of overall marketing of Wilson Daniels, how much effort do you spend marketing yourselves versus the portfolio?
Not much, which is why I say I think that's going to be, I wouldn't say a focus, but it's going to be something we put a little bit more interest into going forward for a lot of reasons. I mean, first of all, I think we're proud of what we do. We have a really passionate team. So I think, you know, the team deserves to be kind of lifted up and for us to spend maybe a little bit more time talking about some of the successes that we've had and how the portfolio is different. But I also think, as you guys, I'm sure know, you know, being in the business, I think that the industry is changing quite a bit. So I think consumption is down for the first time in a long time. And, you know, I'm sure you're the same. Every time I open my social media, there's, you know, articles about drinking less and, you know, health and low calorie. So I think that making a more of a message about what we believe in the future might be interesting. And perhaps coming up with a little bit more of a personal approach to the market and to the consumer of what Wilson Daniels values are, I think could be interesting, because I do think consumers are becoming more value driven. I don't mean value in price. I mean, you know, their own values and following companies that kind of have the same passions that they do. So I think that's going to be maybe something we look at in the future, but it's not something we've done very much of. We've been so busy, you know, focused on our producers for good reason.
And last question about producers. So when you're working with a winery and you want to establish a targeted retail price, is that something that they have in mind, you're making recommendations for, and how do you go about thinking that and solving that problem?
The first thing we really do is they provide us with their price, with an FOB. And we're pretty, that's the one place that we're pretty rigid in. If they give us X price, you know, we put our margin that we think is fair. We don't vary too much from it up or down. And that's the price to the market. And then we really work hard to keep it consistent. Like I said, the one area, well, two areas that we might, you know, push back a little bit or try to negotiate is if we think we're being priced out of a really important price category. Like if we think that we're just completely out of the buy the glass realm, which buy the glass has gone up so much these past few years, what people are willing to spend. But I also feel like that might be hitting a ceiling. So, you know, we're the ones who are, you know, living here in the States, we're seeing this all the time. So I do think it's important to have those conversations. If you really truly feel like, hey, we've been successful these last 8 years with these price increases, but we think we got to tone it down a little bit, like we're going to hit a ceiling where we are going to lose this business. I think it's important, you know, not to cry wolf. You can't say that every year. So we've absorbed quite a few price increases because that's the way the world has been going, you know, these last 4 years, especially. But I feel the industry contracting a little bit. And I think it is important to be, you know, really communicative with what we're seeing in the market. And then the only other time we would really push back is if there's just an enormous price increase that is hard to have, you know, a reason for when you go to the market. And when we have those conversations and we don't get anywhere, we ask the winery to share with us, you know, what is the message then? Is it because, you know, the land has gone up? If you're sourcing from somebody, is it, you know, during the supply chain issues we had, we all knew that there was incredible price increases and supply issues with glass, with corks, with everything. So, you know, as long as we understand, we can translate that message back to the market, but we have to be honest also and look out for the business at the end of the day.
I know I've experienced when buying Burgundy, when prices have come out with a New Year's prices, I've like, oh, it's because of supply or shortages or vintage variation and things like that. But prices never go down when there's a bumper crop or there's a...
They never go down.
It's
I know.
It's quite painful. So, and a quick follow-up on pricing. What are your thoughts on... I know you want to have relatively rigid pricing when it comes to the trade and also retail. What about on wine lists? Because I sometimes see the variance I see in some of these high-end Burgundy prices at certain restaurants. They make it like, hey, this is an actual reasonable price that it's accessible, and I'm gonna try that. I'm gonna splurge this evening or something like that. And other prices, it seems like people are just pricing it so high that it's becoming like just something to have on their list that's gonna collect dust.
Well, I will say we want people to drink the wines we represent, and so do our producers. I mean, they truly do. And I think it's a disservice to the wineries and also the guests in the restaurant when some of these wines that someone might be so excited to find are completely, you know, unattainable. I understand sometimes with highly allocated wines, you don't want them to fly off your list. So maybe you've got to find that sweet spot, right? But you also see how many people flock to those restaurants that have great prices on great wines, you know? So I think finding somewhere in the middle is important. And if you're going to be, you know, one of those restaurants that is going to have a smaller markup, maybe like a 2-time markup, then get the word out there. Cause I think it's actually a great way to establish your clientele, you know, people who love wine and are going to drink a second bottle because of that price. I think if I were a restaurateur, which I'm very much not, I would definitely be intrigued by that model. But, you know, maybe that doesn't always work because it's more people that are in the business that recognize that good deal. So I think it's difficult for restaurants to find what that sweet spot is so they can hold on to the very highly allocated wines while also selling through what they have. I'm interested in you guys' thoughts on that, actually.
Well, yeah, as you said, I think we recognize that a little bit more when there's a good pricing and good deal. And definitely, I think it's more of a turn off when, you know, the markup seems really high and I probably don't go back to that restaurant. But I don't know that it's as attractive, at least for me, on the reverse. Like, if there are great wines at a good deal, but if the food and everything else doesn't match and it's just for that, then it's not going to be as attractive. It's got to be everything together. So that's a little tough.
Agreed. That's why the restaurant business is difficult. I'm glad that's not my dog.
I'm definitely a person that will buy if I see something that it's like, hey, I can't get this on my own or easily. And, oh, I've been wanting to try that. And I don't need that much of a thing to push over the edge, but it's like, when it's like 5x, what I know what it costs, like it's a bit hard. It's not, I can't stomach it for the most part. And so
it doesn't feel good. Yeah. It doesn't feel good.
It unfortunately seems more common these days, especially coming out of the pandemic, that markups are higher and higher. So you mentioned, and you talked a little bit about the private client sales and how that team works. How do you think about the split between private client and wholesale and even allocating a wine like, you know, Romani Conti between those two teams within your own organization?
It's a very small piece of our business because, like I said, it's 300 people as opposed to, you know, the 330 million people we're selling to across the country. So it's a very small piece of the business that we will have a tough time growing because of the limited quantities of wine, right? Kind of the way I was saying we do with pricing, we're pretty diligent with having a certain piece of every allocation that we do the same thing every year so that everyone's happy. You know, our distributors, our retailers, our restaurants are relatively, based on the vintage, happy with their allocation. And our clients, our collectors, are happy with their allocation. So it doesn't vary very much from year to year. It's more about managing when we have a tough vintage, which, again, in full transparency, we keep a library for those occasions so that we can help out our clients, our collectors, our distributors, our customers from tough vintages like we are about to go through with Romani Conti and like we went through last year with Domaine La Fleuve with the 21 vintage. So we dip into our library pretty often in order to supplement a down vintage for all channels, but that especially helps the collectors in the private client group. But again, with 300 people, it's a pretty consistent amount of wine that we just kind of pull off every year. And everybody knows about it. It's transparent within the company, so there's no surprises to anybody.
And just out of curiosity, how do people become one of these 300? Is there like, do they have to spend a certain amount of money or have known Jack Daniels or something?
No, definitely not. But Mike is very active and would speak with anybody that comes across his desk or that we pass on, you know, because of course we do get quite a few people who introduce us to somebody else who, hey, this might be, you know, someone that's interesting for your program. Mike will speak to them, kind of figure out what their interest is. And as we talked about earlier, one thing that is important to us is looking through the whole portfolio and being kind of a part of the Wilson Daniels private client community rather than just writing a check once a year, you know? So I think it's almost more based on that, more based on putting together a group of people who are passionate about the wines. To be honest, we would also prefer, you know, more diversity in our customer group in all channels. I think that's another thing to look at going forward in the wine industry in general, right? So I know Mike has focused on looking at certain markets. It doesn't feel great when we look around the room and everyone looks the same, right? So he's very interested in recommendations from some folks who maybe it's diversity in age or gender or race or economic status, you know? So it's an ever evolving kind of group of individuals. And you know, like I said, it's not going to grow too much. So that's a difficult job that Mike has, and I don't have to worry about it too much.
The wholesale system, especially in the well, in general, I think globally is kind of built around selling wine, right? It is selling it as quickly as possible to anyone and everyone for the most part, right? How do you balance that with building brands? How do you sort of almost create friction for them to so that you can build a brand versus just, you know, maybe for some people dumping wines at really totally margins.
It's tricky. I mean, that's a very, very good point. And, you know, I've mentioned our distributors many times and they're amazing. They've done such a good job. We would not have had the growth that we've had these last 8 years without their partnership. And they've become true partners and in some cases friends, but sometimes it's tough because they are held to a standard of low inventory, which we're experiencing now more than we've ever experienced, quite honestly. And that is like the antithesis of the Wilson Daniels portfolio, because if you're looking at days on hand, it's those allocated items that are going to make it look like we're long on inventory. And, you know, that's ridiculous because the wine's literally appreciating while it's sitting on your floor in your warehouse, right? So we have so many conversations about inventory, which I mentioned is, you know, not the sexiest part of the job, but one of the most important. That goes with getting orders, because if they look like their Wilson Daniels inventory is long, but because of that, they're not ordering enough, you know, Parasol Rosé to honor all of the commitments that we have out there and restaurants, et cetera, that's a real problem. And that's when our relationship becomes very important, because I think with our success over the last 8 years, but also kind of the partnerships we've built with them with from a level of trust going both ways, it's definitely helped so that we can kind of argue the fact that like, you can't really look at us the same way as you look at a lot of other suppliers. That's helped to an extent, but when they're being held accountable to, you know, not just inventory, but also allocations and, you know, revenue, which our wines can certainly help out with revenue quite quickly. But if they're not sticking to our allocation plan, then that's a big problem. So there's a lot of things that are a little bit probably more difficult with our portfolio than they are with others. But what they get in return is, you know, the amazing wineries that we represent and the cachet that the portfolio brings to them. I will say, on that inventory note, it kind of goes back to the pricing. Again, I'm sick of hearing myself say it because, gosh, it's really like not that fun of a topic. But distributors often want to close wines out, right, when they've been sitting so long. We never, ever allow a distributor to close wine out. We would prefer to take it back. And we do that, you know, a few times throughout the year. Rather than lower one bottle of wine, even $1, we would prefer to buy the wine back from them. And I think that message has really gotten through to them. So we're not even getting that ask very much anymore, but it certainly wasn't the case, you know, years ago. So I think kind of sticking to our word and also kind of sticking to our guns a little bit with those things that I talked about, like managing pricing and inventory, has been really crucial in kind of making sure the wines are cared for the way that we laid the plan out for.
So, I mean, obviously you mentioned inventory a bunch in terms of looking at that. When you start to see inventory building up and not seeing new orders coming through, how are you incentivizing your distributors to kind of do that? You just said you don't do closeouts, so that obviously cutting the price would be one. But what are some other ways that you are incentivizing to make a change there to move the product?
We sometimes do distribution-based programming. We have to do it on only a portion of our portfolio. So to give you a really specific example, because we're in it now, every year we've kind of fine-tuned one program that we do in all 50 states called our Fast Start program. It's not rocket science, obviously. You can like figure out what that means, but it's not based on volume. It's based on going out there and getting distribution, getting new placements. And we can only do it on some of those scalable wineries. So we've identified 9 wines in a category, in a grouping, that every year we incentivize the sales reps of our distributors to go out there and get new placements. And we do that in the hopes of we're not going to have inventory issues. We're getting all these placements. The business is going to keep turning. If there are issues, then I don't know, we don't do it very often, but we could put this program in the fall for like one brand, right? We have this something else that we call our wholesale manager bonus, which again, not a very sexy name, but it's basically allowing our team members to tailor a program for the management in our distributors that's 12 months throughout the year. So a lot of those are trip based, but if we find we're struggling with something, to your point, that we want to make sure that, you know, say it's August and we have 4 months to turn something around, we either make a decision that we're going to take the wine back, but we also want that market to achieve their goal, you know, because there's bonuses on the line. So we would prefer to come up with, you know, a healthy way to drive business. So sometimes it's asking to be put on focus, you know, of the distributor, which costs nothing. Or sometimes it's us trying to do some sort of a drive or market work or getting the producer into the market, which there is a lot of. And sometimes that's just the bump you need, you know.
How do allocations, especially between private client and trade, work for highly allocated products like any of your Burgundy selections, Le Flav or DRC?
It's definitely down to the account level, as I mentioned a couple of times. The main focus in our decision is profile accounts. You know, Aubert himself has said many times, A, he wants people to drink the wine, but he also wants the wines. He doesn't want the wines to be flying around the world, nor does any producer, right? Because the quality of the wine diminishes, the price escalates, and we don't have control over the end consumer anymore. So we really look for customers who share that same value of the wine, that someone that's going to treat the wines with respect, especially with storage and not reselling it. But as far as the allocation process, you know, history comes into it a little bit, but it's really about looking at those accounts that make the most sense for the wineries themselves. And of course, looking at what we have that year based on the vintage. But it's not rocket science.
And how do you debate between a retail and a restaurant in terms of making that split? Because obviously with some of these allocated wines, like I've heard of some producers saying, I just want to be in restaurants. I don't want to be at retail.
I'm sure, you know, in some states it's illegal for us to to dictate channel mix. But yes, we do have some producers that would prefer for most of their wines to be in restaurants. So we look at that fairly. We do try to hold back some of the allocation that comes to us every year so that when there's new restaurants opening, we can support them. When, I don't know, if there's a special event or something with really great partners, we would love to be able to say yes occasionally. So we try to get most of the vintage out upon release because people are looking forward to it and have a plan for it in many cases. And then we try to keep some where we can sell it just based on occasion and instances that pop up.
So you also have a book of domestic wineries. How do those differ in your sales and marketing process or business model versus the imports?
Not very much, actually. We treat them the same as far as being a sales and marketing company, right? So as far as allocations in some cases, as far as marketing strategy, relationships with the press, they really have the same needs as our imported wines, except for just the need to be imported, you know, but that's pretty simple. So yeah, we treat them very similarly. And that portion of the book has grown a little bit. We have, you know, Bergstrom came on board a couple of years ago. I mentioned Composition from Bertrand de Valen. I mentioned Hyde de Valen. Of course, Schramsberg is one of our, you know, dearest partners and longest term partners. So we're certainly adding to the book. Arista from the Russian River Valley has been really fun to work with. That was an interesting relationship because Arista was selling 100% of their wines selling DTC. And the only reason they decided to come to Wilson Daniels, and we can't take credit for this. This was, I think, the year before we started. So this was like 2014. But they were smart to realize that they didn't have any presence in the restaurant world, especially on the East Coast, you know, so they still do most of their business DTC, and we get, you know, a good amount of it, but certainly not most of it, because they had clients that they didn't want to walk away from. And we, you know, committed to getting their wines to be highly visible in restaurants around the country. So that's an interesting example, I guess, of, you know, a domestic winery that did have a little bit of different needs, because they could sell everything if they wanted to. But it came down to sales and marketing. They couldn't do it with the small team that they had in all 50 states around the country.
So in 2018, you acquired a distributor, Galaxy Wine, to build out your own distribution capabilities. What was the rationale behind that purchase?
It was very opportunity driven, I'll say. We did not feel that we were properly represented in that marketplace. And we heard that Galaxy was up for sale. We had a very high opinion of Galaxy. I mean, they have an amazing book, even, you know, before we joined the picture. They weren't representing Wilson Daniels, but they had an incredible import book, you know, representing Vineyard Brands, MMD, some of the Skernick wines, a lot of direct relationships with the Champenois. So really cool book. And the idea of combining Wilson Daniels with that portfolio and then running it ourselves seemed like a great opportunity. So that was that. And then, so we purchased Galaxy in Oregon, and then we opened Galaxy in Washington, I think 2 years ago, which was a whole nother feat, because that's very different starting from scratch than purchasing an existing company. But it's been very successful. I think we're up to about $100 million with our 5 wholesale units. And, you know, we've increased our national business and visibility quite a bit. But it's a tough business out there, wholesale, right? You're touching every case, and, you know, we're managing trucks and warehouses now. So it's definitely been a lot of work, but really rewarding.
And how does the wholesale division operate differently or intersect with the import work that you're doing?
It's really fun, actually. You know, we're colleagues. So I would say the day-to-day doesn't stray too much from how we manage a third-party distributor, because it's still the same. It's still the same story with pricing, with inventory. We obviously do a lot of our visibility activities in those states because we have our own team. They get a lot of support from us. They obviously give us a lot of support in making sure our business is constantly, you know, growing at a pretty rapid rate. But it's more fun, I think, working together and having our own wholesale team. But it doesn't really change how we manage the business. On Friday of this week, we're doing an immersion. It's like a 3-hour immersion that some of the national team, including myself, will be kind of kicking off the year to our own wholesale team in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And I doubt any other distributor would give us 3+ hours to do that. So maybe that's a difference. But other than that, it's pretty similar.
So just stepping back into the macro trends for wine, what do you see as the next big trends for wine importing in the U.S.?
I think, gosh, I feel so much change right now with the wine industry. I really do. So it's like the great unknown. But I hope that authenticity is going to become increasingly important, because it does seem like health is becoming more important, which is great. The low alcohol world is a thing. It's not our thing, right? Like, we're not going to try to really get in that business because it doesn't match our core competency. But I do think that's a trend, and maybe like a long term. I don't know if trends can be long term. There might be a word for that. But I think that's going to stick around. I do think that consolidation I mentioned earlier is a massive impact to our business, because I think a lot of the smaller wineries and even smaller suppliers are going to get lost. And I think that's a shame. You know, it's not amazing for the folks that walk into a restaurant and want to try different things. But that's been happening for a while. But as you guys have seen this past year, it's really been, you know, it's been pretty rampant, especially with some of the wineries in California and then some of the companies overseas. But I think, because of all those things, I think for us, differentiating luxury wine from volumetric wine might be more important than it has in the past. And figuring out how to separate it, not in the trade, because the trade already knows this, but how to separate luxury wine from wine that you see an advertisement on television for, to the general consumer, is a big project that I think it's time to undertake as an industry of fine wine.
It's sort of like alcohol versus fine wine, right?
Totally.
And fine wine elevating life and alcohol being something you use to get drunk, right? And
Totally. Yeah. Like tying in biodynamics and vineyards and like, you know, 21st generation families making wine in the same place they've been making it, but like trying to tie that in to an actual consumer level instead of just at the trade, I think is going to be something we'll try to do. We'll see.
As we go to wrap up at this episode, we always like to end on a personal note. So we are curious, what is your most coveted wine in your personal cellar? And when do you plan on drinking it?
Oh, well, I think I'm much better at selling wine than collecting it, I will say. I do have a couple special bottles. I still have some 2002 Ceylan from my days at Vineyard Brands that I would be open to enjoying at any moment soon. And yeah, other than that, just like, I don't know, a bunch of samples.
<That's so exciting. laughs> The 2002 Ceylan sounds perfect. Sounds perfect.
Yeah, I think it does too.
We want to thank you for being so transparent and open and sharing so much information about Wilson Daniels and to get really help our listeners get an insight about, you know, what it takes to sell and market these families that have been making wine for so long. Appreciate your time.
Well, thank you guys. It was really, really good to meet you and very fun chatting with you both. This was great. Thanks for having us. I really appreciate it. It's nice to be able to kind of take a step back and think about what we do and chat about it with you guys. So thank you.
Thanks for joining us. If you loved this episode of Ex Chateau, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, cheers.